Okay, well, we are happy this evening to have Dr. Dan Wallace again. It was a year ago that he was here. He gave three lectures on the integrity of Scripture and the antiquity of its manuscripts. That wasn't his title, but that was the subject. For those of you who don't know Dr. Wallace, Dan teaches Greek at Dallas Theological Seminary. I think his official title is Senior Professor of New Testament Studies. He's also the Executive Director of the Center for the Study of New Testament Manuscripts, and in that capacity, he travels all over the world photographing and digitizing old Greek New Testament manuscripts. And he may have introduced us to that somewhat last year. I've seen pictures of what he does, and it's state-of-the-art technology that is preserving ancient New Testament documents for the future. Very important work that he's doing. Dr. Wallace is an authority in his field. He is a lecturer, a writer, a debater, and again, we're privileged to have him with us this evening. I like your title for tonight. I look forward to your lecture.
Thank you. Should I call you Dr. Duncan, Reverend Duncan? Dan. Well, good evening. Good to see you all. I want to thank you, Dan, for the privilege of being here again. Let's open in a word of prayer, shall we? Father, we thank you for your grace to us, for allowing us the privilege and granting us the privilege of living in a country where we can worship you freely. We thank you for the history of the Bible and what it means to us and how vital it is for our faith. We ask that these next three Wednesday nights will be enriching for all of us and that we can come to love our Lord Jesus Christ that much more deeply because we know more about the history of getting the text into our hands today. It's in his name we pray. Amen. Well, I want to lecture for the next three Wednesday nights on the book that changed the world 500 years ago. Tonight, I'm going to talk to you about five momentous events of the last millennium. And I got to thinking about this in the year 2000. I was doing, it was prior to blogs, just a post on the internet, about what the great events of the second millennium AD were. And I thought about a number of different events, and I think I came up with 10 momentous events for the world, especially the Western world, in the second millennium AD. And among those would be things like in the 19th century, the Industrial Revolution, the invention of the telephone, which now has become a personal computer that we carry everywhere, the automobile, the birth of modern medicine, those kinds of things from the 19th century. The 20th, World War I, World War II, not necessarily great inventions, but momentous things that have happened, with over 60 million people killed in World War II, the Turing machine, basically behind the computers, modern-day computers, the rise of communism, airplanes, space travel, and the moon landing, and radio, TV, the nuclear bomb, internet, things like that. All these things were significant events of the 19th and 20th century. But as I got to thinking about this more, I realized that there were five major events within a 65-year period from the second millennium that were not even close to the time that any of us were born. They all happened about 500 years ago. So between 1453 and 1517, we had these five great events. And I'm going to go through tonight and discuss what each of those is. These five events within the 65-year period that were five of the most momentous events of the second millennium, it's really astounding to think about. And the first one is the one that most of you may not even know about. It's the date of the Muslim invasion of Constantinople. It was May 29th, 1453. That's the one that got the rest of these events, at least a couple of them, rolling. Mehmed II, sometimes called Muhammad II, he was the Sultan of the Turks, and they had started to conquer Asia Minor. They were around Constantinople, which was originally called the New Rome. This is where Constantine the Great in the 4th century had moved his capital from Rome to today's Istanbul. And he built, at the time, the largest church in the world. after a few earthquakes, it kept getting rebuilt until at this time in 1453, it was indeed the largest church by far in the world. And I'll show you some pictures of this. This is a photograph that I took actually on the day that, well, not the year, but the right date that the walls fell, May 29th. I actually walked on top of these walls on May 29th, 2004, and I wept over what had happened to the city. These walls, this was the most fortified city in the world at the time. And the Turks invaded it. They conquered it after 7 weeks of bombardment with huge cannons. The cannons had started to be used about 70 years earlier. And they had these cannons that would shoot 2 foot diameter cannonballs. Can you imagine that? They could only shoot about 7 of them in a day. It would take 3 hours to load one of these things. And they didn't have too many of them, but it was just amazing. They found the various places on the wall where it was going to be weak, and that's where they decided to invade. It was a triple wall, very high, and they had, Mehmed II had between 80,000 and 100,000 soldiers, and there were altogether inside the city 7,000 able-bodied men that could defend it. That was it. The monks and the scribes who had written out copies of scripture and classical Greek texts had already fled the city. Starting the day after Easter, on April 2nd, Monday after Easter that year, is when Mehmed's soldiers came up and surrounded the city, and they bombarded it for the next 7 weeks. What's interesting is on that Easter, these priests were praying, Lord, give us peace just for this last Easter. We know we're doomed, but we want to have peace through today. So here's a map of the city. It wasn't very, very wide, maybe a couple miles in width and a couple miles in length. But you can see where the places were. But here's one of those cannons. I wish I had a person to stand next to it to show you how big these things were. It would take 60 oxen to drag one of these to the site. That's a big boy. And here's one of these cannons, an old painting of it. And this really is what the walls look like. With the red brick and then the white stone between it, you'd almost think that's a modern thing, but that's how they did it back then. And here's where they finally broke through at the middle wall of partition, same word that's used in Ephesians chapter 2 of the divide between Jews and Gentiles, and this is what it was called there. So fascinating that this is the very thing that was broken down here as well. This was the largest church in the world at the time. The Hagia Sophia, or as the Greeks call it, the Hagia Sophia, holy wisdom is what it means, or saint wisdom. It's an absolutely massive church, and it had, for many centuries before this and after this, the largest dome in the world, and it may still be the largest in the world, I'm not sure, but it's just a massive expanse, and the reason that they could have such a big dome is they used hollow bricks, so it wouldn't weigh very much. It's just incredible. So 3 days later, after Constantinople was invaded, this became the largest mosque in the world on Friday, June 1st, 1453. To this day, still, many Greeks mourn Black Tuesday is what they call it, the day that the Muslims invaded in that year, May 29th. And they closed down shops in Athens because they say, this is a tragic day for us. We were at the Ecumenical Patriarchate of Constantinople photographing manuscripts for a month when we overlapped with the state, and so we took that day to spend some time on the walls and visit the city. And I talked to our liaison about the tragic fall of Constantinople, and I said, you know, it was kind of risky what I was saying to him because we were in the midst of shooting manuscripts and they could shut us down anytime they wanted. But I said, you know, it seems to me that the fall of Constantinople was very much like the early church when you had all these apostles who were staying in Jerusalem until they got persecuted by this young man named Saul. And what looked like a terrible tragedy at the time ended up in the providence and design of God to be one of the greatest things that ever happened to the church. It got those apostles out of town so they could fulfill the Great Commission. Preach the gospel to all the nations, not just to the Jews in Jerusalem. And I think what happened here was one of those great events as well. You had all these monks and scribes flee the city before the soldiers could come in, and that's why there were only 7,000 able-bodied men left, including monks and scribes, the ones that stayed behind. And they took their manuscripts with them, and they went to Western Europe. And it gave a shot in the arm to the Renaissance that had started a few decades earlier, and it really was the material catalyst for the beginning of the Reformation that would begin a few decades later. So the fall of Constantinople is huge in the history of world affairs and in a very positive way, because it got all these Greek manuscripts out of Constantinople where they had been produced for centuries. It was virtually the only place for centuries where these classical texts and biblical texts had been produced in Greek. And consequently, 5 years later, the first university in Europe ever to offer a course in Greek took place. It was the University of Paris, 1458. They offered the first course in Greek. The first grammar on ancient Greek was then written a few decades after that by this fellow by the name of Philip Melanchthon. You may have heard of him, Luther's right-hand man. And I've got a copy of his grammar. It's all in Latin, so if you don't know Latin, you can't read his Greek grammar, but that was the very first one. So that was the first event. The second great event during the 65-year period happened about a year afterwards. Think about that, these two unbelievably momentous events happening so close to each other, and that's the invention of Gutenberg's movable type printing press. This is not that printing press, but it's a duplicate of it. And we're not exactly sure when Johannes Gutenberg invented the printing press. We know that it was in the 1450s, and 1454 is probably the closest we can get to when he actually produced his magnum opus, his great work, which was the Latin Vulgate. And it's the Gutenberg Bible is what it is. Before that, he did publish a few little pamphlets, and basically the whole idea of a movable type printing press is you'd have the sheet. Nowadays, I have to explain it because we don't have these anymore. Printing is not done on printing presses, and he'd have these lead letters that he'd have to put in by reverse, lock them in, and then he could print as many pages as he wanted to without rolling the ink on each time. And when he did his Bible, the Gutenberg Bible, he made between 160 and 180 of these Bibles. That was it. You'd think, hey, come on, didn't you have a little foresight, Johannes? You could have made a few thousand and sell these. One leaf of the Gutenberg Bible today is worth between $50,000 and $75,000 for a single leaf. There are about 40 of these still in existence. They're worth millions. One of them is at the University of Texas, proudly displayed there. Another one is at the Library of Congress. I've seen at least seven of them, and that's because I've seen five in Mainz, Germany, at the museum where Gutenberg did his printing work. But it's said to be the most beautiful printed book ever. You think, look at the ornate beauty of this, and here's a straight-on picture of it. It's really stunningly gorgeous with all these colors. The problem is that the beauty of the Gutenberg Bible is from all these multicolors in the margins, which were hand-painted. It's not part of the printing process. Those were done afterwards. And the printing process was just the text. To get the different colors, they had to do that by hand. But it's kind of a shame when you think the very first printed book and everything after that is going downhill. You know, nothing has looked as good. One of the things I've been studying in the last few years is this shift from manuscripts to the printing press and how significant it is for our memories, how we study, how we learn. One of the things that's interesting about the manuscripts, and Stratton can attest to this because he's gone to Greece in the last 2 years. He's almost lived over there more than he has in America. He's seen these manuscripts up close and personal, if you will, and photographed tens of thousands of pages, I know. These handwritten manuscripts have paintings in them, icons of the evangelists, of miniatures of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and others. And they have a gilded background where it's a gold leaf that is glued on to the page. And then on top of that, they have these beautiful colors, including what you have here in the Gutenberg Bible, which is very, very rare at the time, and that is blue paint. This was made from the stone, the lapis lazuli stone. They had to grind it down, and it literally cost more money than gold to get blue back then. And that's why we don't have very much blue in Renaissance paintings. We did not have an artificial, a synthetic blue paint until the 1700s when it was made in either France or Italy. I forgot where, but that's when they started to get blue back into paintings, and that's why we have it so much today. So don't take blue for granted. It's a beautiful color that helps us with our memory. And these medieval manuscripts were intended to help you with your memory. You'd get to a certain page and they'd make a certain letter larger so you knew you were in a different section. Larger, and it would go out into the margin. You talk about indentation. This is called ekthesis, is the Greek word for it. So if it's outdented, it's called ekthesis. And those enlarged letters would tell you you're in a new section, a new paragraph, and it would be filled in with certain colors, all to aid the memory. Now think about this. Manuscripts, until the printing press, were written in such a way that would aid the memory because people could not own these things. They were so expensive, a church might have one Bible or part of a Bible. And after the printing press, now individuals could own them. But until that time, that was simply not the case unless somebody was a wealthy patron. So what happened up until the time of the printing press is the way people learned was by using their memory far more than after the printing press. You hear today about scholars who question the evangelists, those who wrote the Gospels, whether they got it right, whether they got the story of Jesus right. And they use analogies of modern memory, which is absolutely the worst analogy you could use. Modern Westerners' memory, in fact. The ancients knew how to memorize because reading was not very many people in Jesus' day actually knew how to read. Most Jewish boys did. But others, it was about a 20% literacy rate in the culture at large in the Greco-Roman world. So when people wanted to learn something, they had to do it by hearing. And when they heard something, they had learned all sorts of techniques to memorize this. You even have this today in a number of places that are far removed from modern technology. Recently, there was a missionary who was in Africa, and she gave one of the parables of Jesus to some, she just read it to some Muslim children one day. The next day, she came back, about 100 kids, and she said, "Do you all remember that parable I read to you yesterday?" As you know, parables aren't very long, but still, it was a parable. They not only said yes, but they recited it in unison perfectly, having heard it once. Now, we can't do that today because we don't use our brains in the same way. We say, "Hey, I've got it on my iPhone. I can just snap that up real quick." And so we are lazy about memorization simply because we don't need to memorize. Up until the time of the printing press, people had to. Before the manuscripts that we had that were done on what's called a codex, our modern book form, people had to memorize even more because all the books were on scrolls. But the printing press was a major game changer. On the one hand, it made books cheaper. People could own them. Individuals could own books. On the other hand, it made memorization harder. There was not nearly as great a need to memorize. When Luther translated the New Testament into German, the first time it was translated, the whole Bible into German, he wrote a preface in his commentary on Romans shortly after that translation. He said, "Every single Christian should memorize this book and know it word for word by heart." Now here, they had the German Bible for just a few years. And he's saying, "You guys have an obligation just to memorize this." Now we've had it for over 500 years, and we think, "No, I don't need to do that. All I need to do is have a couple words in some kind of a link, and I can find out what verse I'm looking at." We have changed in how we think about accessing information. In fact, there have been three great inventions in terms of information access in the last 2,000 years. The first was the codex, invented in the late 1st century A.D., moving from a scroll to a codex, our modern book form where it's bound on one side and, you know, cut pages. The second was the printing press, and the third is the internet and personal computers. Now, if you want to access some information, you don't even read a whole paragraph, you don't read a whole page, you don't read a whole book. You just Google what you're looking for, do some kind of a search to find it. People often, nowadays, younger generation, millennials, won't even read the whole sentence. There's no need to do that as far as they're concerned. They just need to find that word or that phrase. And so the way we are accessing information is radically different from how it used to be. Consequently, when you think about memory in Jesus' day, This was state of the art. The Jews especially were phenomenal at memorizing things. And that was really true right up until the time of the printing press, that much of the Western world was like this as well. Okay, so that's the second great event. Within about a year of each other, these two momentous events happened. Then the third one is one you all should know about, Columbus' discovery of the New World on October 12, 1492, when he came to the Bahamas. And they were about to turn back, and then the man in the, what's that? The crow's nest? Is that what it's called up high? Thank you, I've forgotten. So he's in the crow's nest, and just when they're about to turn back, he spots land. And this was the last day that they were going to give Columbus his crew before they said they were going to head back. And so they went to the Bahamas, and it opened up horizons for knowledge and European imperialism, if you will. It also created an adventurous spirit of people taking risks and being bold to go against the status quo, if you will. Here's a map of that world. A little bit later, this was penned in 1806, but you can see the Atlantic is now called the Western Ocean. I would call it the Eastern Ocean. I'd call the Pacific the Western, but that was that huge event that affects us. The fifth event, if you're counting, you notice that I skipped number four. I'm coming back to that. That's what I'm going to be talking about these next 3 weeks. The fifth event was when Luther nailed his 95 theses to the church door of the Schlosskirche, or the castle church in Wittenberg, Germany. Now, whether he actually nailed them to the door is questionable. There doesn't seem to be record of him having done that at the time, but certainly what he did was he posted these theses somehow, because within a few weeks, they spread throughout Europe, and I think it was about 3 weeks and 100,000 copies were printed off on printing presses. How convenient that that was invented just a few decades earlier. So this is actually on Reformation Day, October 31st, when my wife and I were there in 2002, and the whole town becomes a medieval town on Reformation Day. We're looking at the castle church, which towers above the whole town from the other end of the main street. And it was built during Luther's lifetime. To walk up the tower, it's 289 feet to the top. And I did that back when my knees were okay. Here's a picture of the church door. It's not really the church door where he nailed his 95 theses, because this is a brass door, and that door was made out of wood. But there were relic hunters of the time. You remember how in the Middle Ages everybody wanted to get relics of the cross. They had enough pieces of the cross to build Dallas Cowboy Stadium a couple times over, I think, and you know, that kind of thing. There were at least two heads for John the Baptist, and I've seen the skull of Thomas on Patmos, and I think it's also in England. These guys were freaks. Pieces of this wooden door were just carved out really shortly within a few years of whatever Luther did there, and now they have brass doors that have the 95 theses that he wrote out in Latin. And we were there on Reformation Day, so you see all these people there as well. There was a Lutheran church that went into this church and sang Ein Festeberg, A Mighty Fortress Is Our God, in that very church on Reformation Day. That was pretty cool. Well, as you all know, what this did is it broke down the political and religious stranglehold of the Roman Catholic Church on Europe. It began to get the Reformation in motion. And I should back up and say what it meant at that time to nail something to a church door, if that's what Luther really did, was not disrespectful to the church. This was also the center of intellectual life in Wittenberg. Just like synagogues were in Jesus' day, they were both religious purposes and they were a school during the week. And so when Luther did this, what he was saying is, I'm ready for a debate. He was a professor at the University of Wittenberg. And he said, I want to debate these 95 points. And of course, the news spread throughout Europe and it changed the world. Here I am in the summer of 2009. It's a little bit warmer without all the crowds. Now, at one point, we're not sure if Luther actually nailed the theses to the door, but we do know he said something like this. I don't always nail things to doors, but when I do, stuff happens. All right, so we know about that event. Now I'm going to show you some other pictures that I took in Wittenberg. This is the Stadtkirche. It's the two-towered church that goes all the way back to the 1300s. They've got actually, as was the case in so many of these churches, they had called a Judensau, I think, where they're treating Jews as though they are pigs. And it gets far more graphic than that. I won't give you the details. But they have this on the awning outside the church towards the back. And it's out of brass that's been there since the 1300s. A few years ago, they weren't sure exactly how to deal with this. They didn't want to deface this historical monument, but they wanted to say this is not what we believe anymore, this anti-Semitism. So I thought what they did was very appropriate. They had out of the concrete beneath, on the ground below, they had another brass kind of a statue, if you will, of Jews trying to get out of a gas chamber. They were trying to climb out, and that's right on the ground, right beneath this thing. So instead of destroying and defacing one of these, they actually added another one to say, this is how Germany has changed. For years, the German government did not allow people to even mention the name of Hitler. And so many of them knew nothing about World War II. And then they had the neo-Nazis that started to arise in Germany. And so now the government mandates that not only should students know about Hitler and World War II, but every single high school student in Germany has to go to a concentration camp. That's part of the requirement form. So they have changed, which is really nice to see. So this is looking at the Stadtkirche, or the city church, where Luther preached most of the time. This was the very first Protestant church. And it's looking at it from down the other side of the street. All the towns around Wittenberg, when we were there in 2002, were polluted. They were in disrepair, but Wittenberg was in really good shape. And the reason is because even the communists knew that Westerners come in here and they get money. So the communists, I guess, were capitalists when it came to Wittenberg. This is the town square in Wittenberg on Reformation Day. And you'd have soldiers, medieval soldiers, marching around town. The whole town was in medieval dress. There was a restaurant, the Schwarzer Bear, the Black Bear restaurant, that was actually around in Luther's day. And so we went there and had some pancakes. And it was just really a great event for us. We spent a couple of days there. And the town square, you've got people that are making candles and beating horseshoes and other things. And also in the town square is a nice statue of Luther on one side, and a few feet away is Melanchthon. And they've done it well. The town looks terrific. Here's a look of the whole city from the tower. This is proof that I was in the tower of the castle church. And you can see this Stadtkirche, or the city church, with its two towers. If you go down this right aisle, if you go down about a mile, it's hard to tell how far a mile is, but about twice that distance, you actually get to the monastery that was given to Luther as his home. And he rented it out to students, always at a loss, and so Katie had to run the finances or else they'd be in the poorhouse. When we were there, as I said, I've been there twice, 2002, 2009, I'll be going again in 2017. But when we were there, they were renovating the Lutherhalle, or the Luther Hall, and the whole building had all the furniture taken out. It's the first time it had happened in quite some time. And so this is the Great Hall, or the Great Room, of the Luther Hall. This is where Luther lectured, as far as I understand. His lectures for about a year and a half, 1515 to 1516, on Mondays and Friday mornings, starting at 6 a.m., and he lectured on Romans for a year and a half. And in 1516, before he finished his lectures, that's when Erasmus's Greek New Testament was published, and Luther got his first copy and started using that when he started to teach out of Romans chapter 9. This is also the room where Melanchthon taught first-year Greek classes. Now, I teach first-year Greek. We have a few of those sections at Dallas Seminary. I have 18 students. That's a normal size, maybe a little on the low side. We get a maximum of 25. We cap it at that. Melanchthon had about 200 students. I hope he didn't have to do all the grading. But it was just a remarkable place. There was so much hunger after these Greek manuscripts went into the rest of Europe. And we got out of the Dark Ages, essentially, because of the relearning of Greek that came from the fall of Constantinople. That's what brought it about. That was one of the major things that moved us into the modern era. Well, those four events Now I come to the number four, which is fifth on our list, March 1st, 1516, almost exactly 20 months prior to the start of the Reformation, minus one day. And we have, before Luther, Erasmus, Desiderius Erasmus of Rotterdam, Holland. He was a Dutch humanist who laid the egg that Luther would hatch, is what they said at that time. And even Erasmus alluded to it, and he said, yeah, I laid the egg, but Luther hatched a rotten one. So at a certain point, he kind of disagreed with Luther, but he was kind of on his side to start with. On a human level, what Erasmus did could not have happened without the events of 1453 and 1454. It could not have happened without the fall of Constantinople and the printing press coming about. Those two events together were combined to bring about the Reformation, again, on a human level. And it would not have happened without a change in the climate about how people dealt with authority and complacency, their lives as they were. With Columbus coming to America, making this massive discovery that he never realized was the discovery of the New World, there was a sense of bold adventure and daring that was taking place when Erasmus was around. Well, let me tell you a little bit about him. Erasmus of Rotterdam was born in about 1467, died in 1536. He pretty much paralleled Luther's life, although he was almost 20 years older. And who was he? Well, he was a student who was an illegitimate son of a Roman Catholic priest. His parents, they actually lived with each other for years, and his father took care of his mother. They both died in the plague of 1483, starting in the mid-1300s, when the Black Death first came. You'd get a reoccurrence of the plague throughout Europe all the time. And so he was 16 years old. He moved into a monastery. He picked one in Stein, Holland, that had a nice library. He liked books. And so that's where he decided to live his life, and he became a priest. He had a tremendous thirst for knowledge, and so when he finally was able to leave the monastery, he decided he'd be a student at the number one university in the world, the University of Paris, as a 29-year-old freshman. And he was there only for a few months. He couldn't stand the place, didn't like the way his teachers were teaching. Erasmus was an irascible fellow, if you will. And he was largely self-taught after that. Although he did earn a doctorate, so-called doctorate, in a little town in Italy, he went there and was there for one day and got his PhD in one day of study. That's a degree mill, I think is what we call that today. There was a place in Germany in the early 1900s that would be like that, and they called it a whistle-stop degree, where people would get off the train and they could get a degree and then they'd get back on the train. And so apparently this place in Bologna, I think, was very much like the one in Germany. But it was really more an honorary degree given to Erasmus for the great accomplishments that he had already done. He never really settled down. The man, he was a nomad his whole life. He preferred independence to security. He taught in various European cities, but he didn't really like to teach. He'd rather just study. And how he supported himself was by writing books. Volumes and volumes, hundreds of books and letters were published. There's now several series on Erasmus. There's one that's over 100 volumes of what he has published in his lifetime. And so he didn't want to get paid by teaching because he didn't like to teach. He'd rather just study. And so how do you earn money from that? Well, nowadays, if you're writing books, you get paid royalties on those books. That was not the case back then. That wasn't the case until the 1800s, really. And so Erasmus would do what people did at the time. He would dedicate a book to somebody who was a wealthy patron, who would basically pay for all the research that he went into working on that book and more, and that's how he would pay his bills. He knew Henry VIII. They knew each other when they were young men before Henry became the king. And he was in Holland, in Paris, in Cambridge, England, Turin, Venice, Leuven in Belgium, Freiburg, Basel, several places. He never stayed more than 8 years in any one place, and he finally died in Basel, where he remained and where he got a lot of publications done. He published a lot of classical and patristic texts, all of them in Latin and Greek. He never published a single word in Dutch or in any other modern language. And Erasmus was the Lady Margaret Chair of Divinity at Cambridge University. The Lady Margaret Chair of Divinity is a really prestigious post. I knew CFD Moll, who was a professor there, and he was the Lady Margaret Chair from the 1960s to 80s, I believe. And he was a good friend of mine and a good mentor. And when he was retired, he went back to, at the beginning of the 21st century, back to Cambridge. He lived on the coast close to Hastings. And he went back to Cambridge for the 500th anniversary of the inauguration of the Lady Margaret Chair. Lady Margaret was the grandmother of Henry VIII, and she established this chair in 1503, and Erasmus had it. What's interesting is a few years later, shortly after Erasmus died, all of his books were banned at Cambridge. And we'll get to that story later. William Tyndale was probably one of his students. We can't tell for sure. He was there at the time at Cambridge. We don't have a record of Erasmus teaching, but he would be the only one who would be teaching both Greek and Latin. At least he would be the best one to do that. And Erasmus became the best Latin scholar in Europe of the 16th century. So good was his Latin that even his letters, anytime he would write a letter to somebody, they would immediately go and get it published. And they would collect these during his lifetime so that we have over 1,000 such letters today. But Erasmus didn't begin to learn Greek until he was 32 years old. And yet he became the great Greek scholar of Europe in the 16th century, even with a late start. He said, "It may be asked why I'm learning Greek at my age. I'm determined that it is better to learn late than to be without knowledge, which it is of the utmost importance to possess." So he recognized this, and he recognized it especially for studying the New Testament. That was his love and his passion. And he became the best ancient Greek scholar in Western Europe in the 16th century. Well, he had all sorts of accolades, and let me conclude with a couple of things here. He was called the Prince of the Humanists. He was a true Renaissance man. He was the intellectual leader of Europe. He was called the Ornament of the World. The name of Erasmus will never perish. You have achieved immortality, mostly because of his Greek New Testament that had come out. He was certainly the epitome of the Renaissance man of letters. And yet, even when he spent time in Florence, where you had Michelangelo at times, and Da Vinci who was there, and several other artists and architects, he never mentioned a word about the beauty and the aesthetics of Florence and the things that were going on, because he was focused on books. So some of you may know people like that. They all go to Dallas Seminary, I think. So that was Erasmus. He began by being sympathetic to the Protestant Reformation. He finally had a falling out with Luther, but they had corresponded a little bit. And he felt that the Latin Vulgate, which had been done in the late 4th, early 5th century by Jerome, it was the official inspired version of the Bible for the Roman Catholic Church for over 1,000 years. He thought it was archaic. It was inadequate. You couldn't really fully understand Scripture reading from the Latin. And he felt that knowledge of Greek and Hebrew were necessary, although he passed on Hebrew. He started to study it. He said, "This is too much. I can only stuff so much into my brain. I'm going to forget about Hebrew." And yet became the greatest Latin and Greek scholar in the 16th century of Europe. So I guess maybe there's justification not to learn Hebrew. But I would never say that. And he felt a new Latin translation was needed. And so this 500th anniversary this year is when he published his most controversial publication. Of the more than 100 books that he published, what he published 500 years ago was by far the most controversial. Within his lifetime, 300,000 copies at least were sold. That would be really nice if he had made some royalties on it. And what that text was that he published has strong relevance for the Reformation and for our faith today. And I'll tell you more about that next time. Okay, I guess we have a little bit of time for questions. So that's the end of what I wanted to share tonight.
Well, it's insignificant. What is a patristic text?
A patristic text? Did I mention those?
Yeah. You said that he published a classical.
Oh, yeah. Forgive me. It's commentaries or writings of the Church Fathers, and he was very good at doing that as well.
Is
classical
that
text.
Patria.
Is that Latin?
Patria is Latin, yes, but. You'd have these church fathers, both the Latin and the Greek. He especially liked Jerome. He liked Jerome more than he liked Augustine, unfortunately. But still, he published a lot of these, and he liked Augustine quite a bit, too.
Have they changed the name of Wittenberg? They have, haven't they? The official name?
It was called for a while, and still is, Lutherstadt, or Luther City. So you call it Wittenberg, Wittenberg, the German pronunciation, or Lutherstadt, Luther City, if you want.
That's probably probably what we've heard. We've been there.
Yeah, oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Yeah, even on non-Reformation days, they have these soldiers walking through town, but they don't have quite the same thing in the town square.
I'm just curious, was the anti-Semitism really rampant during Luther's lifetime? I know he...
It was by Luther.
He wrote the book, The Problem of the Jews. I've got it.
Mm-hmm.
it was a disturbing revelation.
Yeah.
I asked Dr. Johnson, as a matter of fact, did he really write this book, or did somebody just put his name on it? And he said, no, he wrote it.
Yeah. John Hanna has said that Luther probably lived 10 years too long. That's when his anti-Semitism really came out. But we ought not to say that Hitler was influenced by Luther. Hitler was not a Catholic or a Protestant. He was more Catholic than Protestant, but he abandoned the faith early on. And that was just in the air at the time, the anti-Semitism. So I don't think in any sense you can say, well, Nazi Germany owes its radical ideas about the Jews to Luther. That's not appropriate and it's not accurate.
Did this kind of happen towards the end of his life, where maybe he had senility or something like that, or Alzheimer's?
I don't know, but it was towards the end of his life. But that could happen to any one of us. We need to...
I mean, he's human. We can't...
Yeah. Question way back there.
Could you elaborate a little bit more on the significance and the effects of Christopher Columbus's discovery of the New World and how it relates to your lecture?
Well, what Columbus did, you may recall that here he is from Italy, but Italy wouldn't sponsor him to go, and so he had Ferdinand and Isabella from Spain to sponsor his trip to the New World. It took him quite some time to get some sponsorship. There just was not the interest in this kind of adventuresome goal, which was not to find the New World. That's not what he thought he discovered. But the governments in Europe were unwilling to sponsor somebody like him. So when he made this discovery, thinking it was India, all of a sudden it opened up some huge doors and it said, bold moves get rewarded. If you're bold and you're persistent, it gets rewarded. It wasn't directly against authority, but it was something that said, I'm going to be bold, I want to pursue these goals. And so the idea of adventuresomeness, daring, taking a huge risk where he could certainly die on the trip over, those were the kinds of things that Erasmus did. And Erasmus, in fact, very much like Luther, had to get protection from one of the popes for the sake of his life. In fact, one pope wanted him excommunicated from the church and others because of this text. And so the next pope, he actually dedicated his book to that man. So Erasmus, he was very cunning. He knew how to work the system well. But he also learned how to be daring. And I think it was just that spirit of the time. This happens just a few years, you know, a couple decades after he's born, that you have Columbus discover America. They were in the rest of Western Europe to a degree, but not nearly as spread as we'd like to see them, because they'd be in Eastern Europe in particular. There'd be some Orthodox monasteries there. But the manuscripts were produced, especially in Constantinople, for several centuries as virtually the only place where they were produced. And when these scribes and monks fled with these manuscripts into Europe, all of a sudden Greek learning grew exponentially. And it's happening at a time when there's a printing press. So those two things together come about. Although we didn't, you know, having the first Greek New Testament published, it's almost 65 years after this event. But there were classical Greek texts that were printed in the late 1400s. And so that started to have an impact on Western Europe. What's interesting is where Erasmus got a hold of his manuscripts. He had eight manuscripts that he used that were at Basel. And I was supposed to go there with Rob Marcello this summer to meet with some scholars at Basel. And they're celebrating the 500th anniversary of Erasmus's publication, and at the end my knee was not good enough to travel. I would have really loved to go there this year. It's not quite the bucket list of going to Wittenberg next year, but it was pretty high on the list. But I've investigated where did Erasmus get a hold of those manuscripts, and all of them were at Basel before Constantinople fell, which was interesting. But they weren't really looked at because you didn't have very many people who knew Greek in Western Europe. There was a revival in Florence in the 1380s, and they actually brought in some Greek scholars who taught them Greek, but Greek was virtually unknown. Hebrew was largely unknown. When Tyndale wanted to learn Hebrew, he had to go to the continent away from England to get it. He went to this little town called Wittenberg to learn Hebrew. Folks, thank you very much. Next week we'll talk about this actual publication that Erasmus did. And even look at some passages, I think, and the third week especially, we'll look at this text that stands directly behind the most famous Bible of all time, the King James Bible, and what the differences are from that and our modern translations and the Greek text they follow. Thank you very much.